This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Joining me now is Dr. René Breton from the University of Southampton. Hello.
Hi.
And he's just given a really, really interesting talk on measuring pulsar masses in black widow and redback systems. So can you tell us what those actually are?
Yeah, they're actually not spiders, as you may think. Black widows and redbacks are actually neutron star binaries. So you have a neutron star which is orbited by a small star about the mass of Jupiter, or a few times the mass of Jupiter, in a very compact orbit. Typically a few hours is the orbital period of these systems. And they're characterized by the fact that the neutron star is very powerful, very energetic. So it emits a lot of relativistic radiation, which heats up the companion, and basically make one side of the companion really, really bright and hot, whereas the other side that's facing away from the neutron star is very cold. And so you have like this half hot and half cold star. And it turns out that the radiation of the neutron star is so intense that it's actually ablating the surface of the companion. And so it peels off layers of gas around, which is why we call them black widow, because it's a little bit like the analogy of these insects that eat their mate after mating.
So you said that it oblates the other star. What do you mean by oblate?
Yeah, so more or less what's happening is that the wind of the energetic neutron star is basically blasting away the gas at the surface of the companion, just a little bit like if you have a very powerful fan that's blowing away gas.
Okay. So if it's always happening sort of on one side, does the companion star not really rotate at all?
It does rotate. The only thing that's very special in these systems is that the rotational period is actually the same as the orbital period, which means that the companion star, is also always presenting the same side to the neutron star. So it's just like the moon around the Earth, actually. So we always see the same side of the moon. So it's exactly the same thing in these systems. But basically, as one side is being peeled away very slowly, the gas will circulate and things remain in equilibrium, basically.
Okay, so you get one side with a lot more gas on it than the other side, because it's sort of being blasted towards that way?
Yeah, but because because gravity pulls from every direction, basically there's always gas that's sort of going towards the front side to make things in equilibrium, basically.
Okay.
So okay. There's no imbalance, really.
So how do you actually, because your talk was on measuring the masses of the pulsars, how do you actually do that?
So we can use these systems to measure the mass of the neutron star, because if you look at them using an optical telescope at wavelengths visible with our own eyes, what happens is that you see color variations. So if you picture the system to be seen almost edge-on, what happens is that sometimes in part of the orbit you see the hot, irradiated side. And when the system is viewed like half an orbit later, you see the cold side. And if the orbit instead is seen more face-on, then you always see a half-hot and a half-cold star. So basically, we can model the light curves of these companions in order to infer the orbital inclination in the system. And this is basically one of the key elements that's missing when we observe these systems to determine the mass of the neutron star. So we combine that with observations made with radio telescopes, such as the Jodrell Bank telescope, in order to determine the velocity of the pulsar, and then using the inclination angle that we measure from the observation of the companion, then altogether we can use that to solve for the mass of the neutron star.
So it takes quite a lot of observations in collaboration with models to get it all to work.
Yes, exactly. The making this happen you know, is really the result of like a synergy of like observations between astronomers specialized in radio observations and also optical astronomers. And so you have to put that all together in order to be able to achieve the mass measurement in the end.
You said that you had to sort of measure the light curves of this. How often do you have to take observations for that?
In principle, we're fine if we observe only a single orbit of one such system. And as long as we get a good coverage and data throughout the entire orbit, this is sufficient. What usually happens is that when we look at the star, it's not necessarily up in the sky for an entire night or for long enough that we can cover the entire orbit in a continuous fashion. So most of the time, we actually have to observe little chunks of the orbit on different nights and stitch all the data together in order to have a full orbit. Another thing we have to take into consideration is that there might be variability, either intrinsic to the system or also just due to experimental errors. So it's usually better if we are able to observe a couple of orbits in order to build up enough statistics to really get accurate light curves that will yield to the mass measurement.
Cool. How long is a typical orbit? Is there a typical orbit? Does it vary a lot?
So these black widow systems, in order to get the irradiation, you need the orbit to be fairly compact. Because if the companion star is too far away, basically the energetic wind from the neutron star will have faded out by the time it reaches it. So we're talking about orbits in which the orbital period is the order of like a few hours. So the shortest we know of is maybe 2 hours, and the longest is the order of like 10, 12 hours. And when you extend beyond 12 hours, the orbital separation becomes too large, and then it's not energetic enough to produce these light curve variations that we're looking for.
Okay, so they're quite short orbital systems for this sort of observation.
Yes, indeed. And actually, this is a bit of a puzzle in terms of like scientific puzzle, because it turns out it's very difficult to form binary systems that are so compact. Orbits that are the order of a day or a few days are more easily formed. And the reason for that is when these binary system evolves, like prior to the formation of the neutron star, you have transfer of mass from the bigger star, the more massive one, to the less massive one. And then the roles will interchange once the neutron star has formed. So the little companion tends to puff up at some point when it becomes a giant star and will transfer mass to the neutron star. And what happens is that the orbit, just by conservation of energy and conservation of what we call the angular momentum, the orbit will tend to expand. So in order to get a really short orbital period, it means you sort of need to start with an orbit that's prior, even shorter than that, or you need a mechanism that will make it shrink. And so this is a lot of fine-tuning for the models of the way we think binary systems evolve. And it's still a bit puzzling because we don't quite understand how we can end up with systems that are so compact.
There's still a lot of work being done on this area of how a binary system formation with pulsars.
Yes, indeed. For instance, there's this one system that I'm working on in which the mass of the neutron star appears to be fairly large. It might be the most massive we actually observed so far, with a mass roughly 2.2 times the mass of our sun. And we think, at least we used to think, that pulsars are born with a rather canonical mass of 1.4 sort of mass.
So they all pretty much have that mass.
Yeah. Yeah, that at least that's the sort of canonical picture. And so this would mean that the pulsar almost accreted one mass of the sun onto its surface to go from 1.4 to 2.2 or so solar mass. And we know this can happen during the mass transfer, except that if you accumulate so much mass, then the orbital parameters will change in such a way that is almost impossible to end up the way we observe the system right now. So at most, that pulse, that neutron star, probably accumulated maybe 0.1 to 0.2 or 0.3 solar mass in the past. So it sort of shows that probably neutron stars are not all born with masses around 1.4 solar mass, but some of them, for reasons that we don't quite understand, maybe it's common, maybe it's rare, but some might be born with masses that are much larger than we used to think.
Okay. So yeah. So how many of these systems are sort of out there? Are there a lot known?
At this point, we have roughly 20 candidates or so. I say candidates because in some cases, we know they are irradiated systems like that. In other cases, we are still at the point where basically they're just brand newly discovered, and we have to look for the signature of the companion in using optical telescopes. What's interesting is that prior to the launch of the Fermi gamma ray telescopes in the mid-2000s, we only knew three or so of these systems. And all of a sudden, we went from three in something like 20 in the span of like 5 years. And this is because of the fact that these pulsars that are like the neutron star is, we know it as a pulsar, which means it emits flashes of light in the radio. And we detected them using the Fermi telescope because they are very bright gamma ray sources. So the way we find them now, most of the time, is that the Fermi telescope looks in the sky, makes pictures, and then sometimes we see a bright point source. And when we can't associate one of such point sources to a galaxy or an object that we know in a catalog or something, then we take a radio telescope and we just stare at this location for a long time and we try to see if there's any radio pulsations. And in a fair number of occasions, we actually do find pulsations, and they turn out as radio pulsars as well. So that's how we find these new systems.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah.
Do they tend to be sort of they're within our galaxy?
Yes, indeed. Pretty much, well, basically all pulsars that we know of or neutron stars that we know of are located in our galaxy. And relatively nearby. So out of these Black Widow pulsars, the furthest that we know of is at a distance of maybe 2.5 to 3 kiloparsec. So in terms of light years, that means about maybe 5,000 light years or so. So it seems pretty far, but this is actually roughly galactic neighborhood
in galaxy terms.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much for the interview, and it was really nice hearing your talk.
My pleasure. Thank you.